Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant with American Giant. They aren't affected by tariffs because their clothing products never left the U.S. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy and features real testimonials.
This was our first time trying therapy, and honestly, it was long overdue. Looking back, we just wish we had started sooner.
Regain's qualified therapists help couples when they can't get there on their own.
We thought it was intimacy issues, but Andrea helped us uncover a deeper root cause we hadn't even realized was there.
Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. Regain, couples therapy that works.
My mom sent me a message saying, "We changed all the locks. You don't have a home anymore." I replied, "How funny, how brave they think they are, haha." Then, 2 days later, I got an urgent email from their lawyer. "We have a problem. Call immediately." I'm Mackenzie Wilson, 28, and last month, my life shattered when I lost my job at a failed startup. But nothing prepared me for returning home to find every lock changed. My phone buzzed with my mother's text, "We changed all the locks, you don't have a home anymore." Through tears I replied, "How funny, how brave they think they are," was always complicated, but this crossed a line I never imagined. Then, 2 days later, an urgent email from their lawyer changed everything. Before I continue my story, let me know where you're watching from and hit subscribe to follow what happened next in this wild journey. Growing up in Oakwood Heights, a middle-class suburb outside Boston, my childhood looked picture-perfect from the outside. Our two-story colonial with its manicured lawn and white picket fence could have been from a real estate magazine. But inside those walls, my parents Patricia and Robert Wilson ran our home like a military academy. From my earliest memories, everything had to be done their way. My mother scheduled every hour of my day piano lessons on Mondays, swimming on Tuesdays, academic tutoring on Wednesdays. My father reviewed my report cards with a red pen, circling any grade below an A with a disappointed sigh. "Mackenzie, excellence isn't optional in this family," he'd say, pushing my B+ math test across the kitchen table. My younger brother Trevor adapted perfectly to their expectations. For years younger than me, he became the golden child by following every rule without question. National Honor Society, captain of the debate team, and eventual admission to my father's alma mater, Trevor checked every box on their perfect child checklist. I, however, was born with questions on my lips. "But why do I need calculus if I want to be a writer?" I'd ask, earning exasperated sighs. "Because Wilson children become doctors or lawyers, not struggling artists," my mother would respond, her tone ending all discussion. By high school, our home became a battleground. I joined the school newspaper while my parents enrolled me in pre-med summer camps. I applied to journalism internships while they scheduled hospital volunteer hours. The constant push-pull exhausted us all, but neither side would surrender. When college application season arrived, I secretly applied to business programs while pretending to pursue pre-med. The day my acceptance letter from Northeastern's business school arrived, along with
"You have 5 new messages."
"Hey Carl, it's Jen from finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?"
"Hey Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, finance. Just need those receipts today." "Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?"
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains June 13th through the 23rd. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Partial scholarship. I finally showed my cards. "I'm going for business, not medicine," I announced at dinner, sliding the acceptance letter across the table. The silence lasted 10 excruciating seconds before my father spoke. "Then you'll do it without our support." They weren't bluffing. While Trevor would later receive a fully funded education, I worked 3 jobs, campus bookstore mornings, waitressing evenings, and weekend retail to cover what my scholarship didn't. Those years taught me independence, but created a canyon between my parents and me that never fully closed. After graduation, I landed an entry-level marketing position at a promising tech startup. The salary barely covered my tiny apartment and student loans, but it was mine. For 3 years, I built my career, visiting my parents' house only on major holidays, where conversation remained superficial and tense. Then COVID hit, Our startup lost its funding, downsized, and eventually collapsed entirely. With the job market frozen and my savings depleted after 2 months of unemployment, I faced the unthinkable, asking my parents to move back home, temporarily. 6 months maximum, I promised as they reluctantly cleared out Trevor's old room, just until I find something stable. From day one, the arrangement was strained. They imposed the same rules as when I was 16. Curfews, chore charts, and mandatory family dinners, where my mother would subtly mention medical school applications, were still an option at my age. Every job rejection email in my inbox became ammunition for their argument that I'd chosen the wrong path. Marketing for tech companies, in this economy? My father would scoff. You could have been halfway through your medical residency by now. Tensions escalated over my 6 month stay. My contributions to household expenses, whatever I could scrape together from occasional freelance work, were dismissed as insufficient. My job search efforts were deemed unfocused. My interviews for positions they considered beneath a Wilson were met with silent disapproval. The final straw came after I lost a promising job opportunity at a digital marketing agency. After 5 interviews, I'd been the second choice. Devastating news I received via email while sitting at the kitchen table. Maybe this is a sign, my mother said, watching me fight back tears. Your grandmother would be so disappointed to see you struggling like this. That comment ignited something in me. My grandmother, my mother's mother, had been my greatest supporter before her death 3 years ago. She'd secretly slipped me checks during college and always told me to follow my passions. Don't you dare tell me what grandma would think, I snapped. She was the only one who ever supported me unconditionally. What followed was the worst argument we'd ever had. Words like ungrateful, failure, and disappointment flew across the room. I accused them of never loving me for who I was. They called me entitled and delusional about my capabilities. I stormed out to clear my head, spending the night at my friend Allison's apartment. The next morning, I had a job interview across town, not my dream position, but something that would get me back on my feet. I sent a text to my mother saying I'd be back that evening to talk more calmly. I never imagined that by evening, I would no longer have a home to return to. The job interview went surprisingly well. The position was for a content marketing manager at a small but stable company, less exciting than my startup days but with reliable pay and benefits. As I walked to my car, I felt a glimmer of hope for the first time in weeks. Maybe this would be my ticket back to independence away from the daily tension at my parents' house. During the drive home, I even practiced what I'd say to smooth things over after last night's fight. Let's start fresh, I rehearsed. I have a good feeling about this interview, and I'm grateful for the roof over my head while I get back on my feet. It was just after 4:30 p.m. when I pulled into the familiar driveway. The house looked exactly as it had that morning, neat hedges. My mother's garden gnome standing sentry, the American flag by the front door gently waving in the autumn breeze. Everything appeared normal. Then, I tried to open the front door. My key slid into the lock but wouldn't turn. That's strange, I thought, jiggling it harder. Maybe it stuck. I tried again, wiggling the key more forcefully, but it wouldn't budge. Hello? I called, knocking on the door. Mom? Dad? The lock seems jammed. No answer. I walked around to the side entrance by the kitchen, the door we used most frequently. Again, my key slid in but wouldn't turn. A cold feeling settled in my stomach as I tried the back door with the same result. Standing on the back patio, I pulled out my phone and called my mother, straight to voicemail. I tried my father with the same result. Finally, I called my brother Trevor, who lived 2 hours away in New York City. Trevor, hey, something weird is happening. I can't get into the house and Mom and Dad aren't answering. A long pause. Mac, I think you should check your texts. I pulled the phone from my ear and saw a new message notification from my mother that had arrived during my call with Trevor. With trembling fingers, I opened it. We changed all the locks. You don't have a home anymore. After last night, we've decided it's time for you to figure out your life on your own. Your things will be boxed up and available for pickup on Saturday when we'll be out. Arranged to have everything removed by 5 p.m. The ground seemed to tilt beneath me as I read and reread the message. My parents had locked me out. They had actually changed the locks while I was at a job interview. My home of 6 months and my childhood home of 18 years before that was suddenly inaccessible to me. Through the shock, I typed back, "How funny, how brave they think they are." The laugh was pure bravado. Inside, I was crumbling. I immediately tried calling again, but both their phones remained off. I looked up at the house, at my bedroom window on the second floor, and realized all my possessions were inside. My clothes, my laptop, my portfolio, my birth certificate and passport, everything. Mac, you still there? Trevor's voice came through the phone I'd forgotten was still connected. Did you know about this? I asked, my voice barely a whisper. Not until an hour ago. They called me after they did it. He sounded uncomfortable. Look, they're really upset about last night. Just give them some time to cool off. Time? Trevor, they've locked me out. All my stuff is in there. My documents, my work materials, everything. I have nowhere to go. Maybe stay with a friend for a few days? I'd offer my place, but Lisa's parents are visiting and forget it. I cut him off, anger replacing shock. Just tell them this is illegal. They can't just throw me out without notice. I'll talk to them, he promised weakly. Just don't do anything to make it worse, okay? I hung up and sat in my car, staring at the house where I'd grown up. Through the kitchen window, I could see my mother moving around, deliberately not looking outside. She knew I was here, they both knew. With shaking hands, I called Allison, the friend I'd stayed with the previous night. Allie? I need a huge favor. Can I crash on your couch again? My parents. My voice broke. My parents changed the locks. They've kicked me out. Allison's outrage was immediate and comforting. They did what? Of course you can stay here. Oh my God, Mac, that's horrible. Do you need me to come get you? No, I have my car. I'll be there in 20 minutes. Thank you so much. As I started the engine, Mrs. Henderson, the elderly neighbor who'd lived next door since I was a child, approached my window with concern written across her face. Mackenzie dear, is everything all right? I saw you trying the doors. I could barely meet her eyes, humiliation burning through me. My parents changed the locks, Mrs. Henderson. They've decided I'm not welcome anymore. Her face fell. Oh, sweetheart, that's not right. Do you have somewhere to go? Yes, a friend's place. But all my things are still inside. She patted my hand through the window. I'll keep an eye out. If I see them leaving, I'll let you know. Maybe you can get your essentials then. I thanked her and drove away, watching my childhood home recede in the rearview mirror, feeling like I was 16 again, powerless, misunderstood, and completely alone. That night on Allison's couch was the lowest point of my adult life. After she went to bed, I finally allowed myself to break down completely. The betrayal cut deeper than I could have imagined. These were my parents, the people who were supposed to love me unconditionally. Instead, they'd literally locked me out of their lives because I didn't fit their predetermined mold. I scrolled through old family photos on my phone until 3 a.m., wondering where it all went so wrong and how I would rebuild my life from scratch with most of my possessions held hostage. Little did I know that in just 2 days, an unexpected email would turn the entire situation upside down. Waking up on Allison's couch the next morning, it took a few disorienting seconds to remember why I wasn't in my bed. Then reality crashed down, I was effectively homeless. The validation of having a permanent address, a key that opened a door to my own space, had been stripped away overnight. I made coffee, Allison said, padding into the living room in fuzzy slippers. Her one-bedroom apartment was tiny but cozy, filled with plants and colorful throw pillows. And I called in sick to work. Figured you could use the company. You didn't have to do that, I said, fighting back a fresh wave of tears at her kindness. Well, someone should be on your side. She handed me a steaming mug. So what's the plan? Plan, right, I needed a plan. First, I tried calling my parents again. Both numbers went straight to voicemail. I left messages that started calm and became increasingly desperate. Mom, Dad, please call me back, we need to talk about this. This is illegal, you know, you can't just throw someone out without notice. Please, at least let me get my important documents and work computer. No responses. Around noon, I drove back to the house, hoping to catch them leaving or returning so I could talk face to face. The driveway was empty, but both their cars were gone. I'd forgotten it was Wednesday, my mother's standing lunch with her church friends, my father's golf day. Mrs. Henderson spotted me from her garden and hurried over. They left about an hour ago, she confirmed. Your mother was carrying a shopping list, so they might be gone a while. I eyed the house, considering my options. Could I find an open window? Should I call a locksmith? But then what, break into my own home only to have them call the police on me? Mackenzie, Mrs. Henderson said gently. Your father gave me this for you before they left. She handed me a sealed envelope. Inside was a typed letter, cold and formal. Any attempt to enter the premises without our permission will be considered trespassing. Your belongings will be available for collection on Saturday between 2 to 5 p.m. as previously arranged. We expect all items to be removed at that time. The letter wasn't even signed, just printed, like a notice to a tenant. I don't understand how they can do this, I said, voice breaking. That's my home too. Mrs. Henderson shook her head sadly. I've known your parents for 25 years, and I've never approved of how they treated you. Your grandmother Eleanor would be heartbroken to see this. The mention of my grandmother sent a fresh ping through my chest. She'd been my safe harbor during the worst storms with my parents. After she passed 3 years ago, I'd lost my greatest ally. Thank you for being kind, I told Mrs. Henderson. At least I know someone's watching the house. I'm worried about my things. I'll keep an eye out, she promised. And Mackenzie? This isn't your fault, remember that. The rest of the day became a blur of logistics, the unglamorous reality of sudden displacement. I visited a nearby coffee shop with free Wi-Fi to job hunt, made an appointment at the DMV to replace my driver's license, the original was inside the house, and called my bank. The bank delivered another shock. My parents had removed me from the joint account we'd established when I was in college, the account where my freelance checks were deposited. The account that contained my last $847 of primary account holders made this change yesterday afternoon. The bank representative explained apologetically. There's nothing we can do since you were listed as a secondary holder. I'd been financially cut off too. My parents weren't just forcing me out, they were systematically erasing my safety nets, one by one. That evening, scrolling through social media on my phone, I saw Trevor had posted family dinner photos, my parents smiling around a homemade lasagna, my mother's specialty. The caption read, "Nothing like mom's cooking, blessed family time." I threw my phone across Allison's couch. "They're acting like everything's normal," I said when she looked up startled. Like they didn't just throw their daughter onto the street. And Trevor's playing along. Allison retrieved my phone. "Your brother's always been their puppet. You know that. He could at least acknowledge what they did was wrong. Family loyalty is complicated," she said. "Speaking of which, you can stay here through the weekend, but Ethan's moving in Monday, remember?" Ethan was Allison's boyfriend. They'd been planning to move in together for months. "Of course, I'll figure something out by then." But the walls were closing in. I'd been job hunting for months with no success. My savings were gone, my possessions were being held hostage, and now I had 3 days to find new accommodations with no income. That night, sleeping fitfully on Allison's couch, I was plagued by stress dreams, showing up to job interviews naked, running through endless hallways of locked doors, my parents laughing as I frantically tried key after key. I woke up exhausted, with a tension headache pressing behind my eyes. "You look terrible," Allison said, not unkindly. "Maybe you should talk to someone, like a therapist? With what money? No, like a lawyer. What your parents did has to be illegal." The thought had crossed my mind, but attorneys cost money I didn't have. Besides, suing my own parents felt like crossing a line even after everything they'd done. "Let me see what happens Saturday when I get my things," I said. "Maybe they'll have cooled off by then." But deep down, I knew better. This wasn't a spontaneous action, it was the culmination of years of conditional love. My parents had finally found the ultimate way to control me by removing my security completely. That afternoon, I used the last of my cash to buy a prepaid phone card, worried my phone bill wouldn't process with my account frozen. I was applying for a barista position, any job would do at this point, when my email notification chimed. "The sender, Sanders and Wilson Law Firm. Subject, urgent. Regarding Wilson family property and assets." My heart plummeted. Were my parents actually suing me now? For what being a disappointment? With trembling fingers, I opened the email that would completely transform my understanding of the past 28 years. The email began formally, "Dear Ms. Wilson, I am contacting you regarding urgent matters pertaining to the Eleanor Wilson Trust, for which our firm serves as legal executor. Recent events have necessitated our immediate intervention. Eleanor Wilson, my grandmother," I read on, my heart racing. "It has come to our attention that your current residential status has been compromised, which constitutes a direct violation of the terms established in your grandmother's trust. We request an immediate consultation to discuss your legal options." The message included contact information for Jonathan Peters, senior partner, and requested I call at my earliest convenience. A confidentiality notice at the bottom warned against unauthorized disclosure of the email's contents. I read it 3 times, trying to make sense of it. My grandmother had a trust, one that somehow involved my residential status? And what did they mean by legal options? With shaking hands, I dialed the number. "Sanders and Wilson, how may I direct your call?" came a professional female voice. "This is Mackenzie Wilson. I received an email from Jonathan Peters about my grandmother's trust." "One moment, please, Miss Wilson." After a brief hold with generic classical music, a deep male voice came on the line. "Miss Wilson, thank you for your prompt response. I'm Jonathan Peters. What's this about my grandmother's trust? I wasn't aware she had one. That's precisely why we need to meet. There are confidentiality concerns I can't address over the phone. Could you come to our office tomorrow morning at 10 a.m? Yes, I can do that." I wrote down the address he provided. "Excellent. And Miss Wilson? Please bring any documentation of your recent living situation and the circumstances of your departure from the family residence." After hanging up, I sat frozen, mind racing. My grandmother had always been the family maverick, a successful business owner who married late, traveled extensively, and frequently butted heads with my mother over parenting philosophies. While my parents pushed me toward prestigious, practical careers, Grandma Eleanor encouraged my creativity and independence. "Some people need to control others to feel secure," she once told me during a particularly difficult period with my parents. True strength is letting people find their own path while standing ready to catch them if they fall. She passed away 3 years ago from a sudden heart attack. The funeral was brief and formal, just as my mother preferred. I remembered being surprised that Grandma's substantial estate seemed to transfer to my parents without much legal process, but I'd been too grief-stricken to question it. Now memories flooded back, little comments my grandmother had made, meaningful glances when my parents discussed her assets, her insistence on speaking with me alone during her final years. "One day, Mackenzie," she'd said during our last visit, "you'll understand just how much I believe in you. Promise me you'll never let them crush your spirit." I'd attributed it to the usual grandmother encouragement. What if it had been something more? That night, I barely slept, my mind constructing countless scenarios. By morning, I'd cycled through everything from inheriting a small savings bond to discovering my grandmother had been a secret millionaire. I arrived at Sanders and Wilson 15 minutes early, acutely aware of my wrinkled clothes and the dark circles under my eyes. The building was an imposing downtown high-rise, its lobby all marble and glass. I felt desperately out of place. At the reception desk, I gave my name with as much confidence as I could muster. "Miss Wilson, welcome," said the receptionist, a polished woman in her 50s. "Mr. Peters is expecting you. 15th floor, suite 1520. The elevator ride gave me time to compose myself. Whatever this meeting revealed, I needed to appear capable and collected. Suite 1520 opened into a tasteful reception area, with leather seating and discreet lighting. Before I could approach the desk, a tall man with silver hair and a tailored suit emerged from an interior office. "Miss Wilson? Jonathan Peters. Please come in." His office was spacious, but not ostentatious, with views of the city's skyline and walls lined with law books. He gestured to a comfortable chair across from his desk. "Thank you for coming on such short notice. I understand you're in a difficult situation." "That's putting it mildly," I said, then caught myself. "Sorry. It's been a stressful few days." "Completely understandable." He opened a thick folder on his desk. "Miss Wilson, were you aware that your grandmother established a family trust prior to her death?" "No. I knew she had assets, but my parents handled everything after she passed. That's part of the problem." His expression turned grave. "Your grandmother established what we call a conditional trust. The Wilson family home, where you've been living until recently, was placed in this trust, along with significant financial assets." My heart began to race. "What kind of conditions?" "The primary condition was that the property would remain your family home with guaranteed residence rights for all direct Wilson family members, including you. Your parents were named trustees, but their right to occupy the property was explicitly contingent on your continued access to the home whenever you needed it." The implications hit me like a physical blow. "Are you saying the house is actually part of my grandmother's trust, not my parents' property?" "Correct. The house belongs to the Eleanor Wilson Trust. Your parents have been receiving a monthly stipend from the trust to maintain the property, with the understanding that it would always remain available to you. And by changing the locks and barring me from entry, they violated the fundamental terms of the trust," he confirmed. "Which is why our firm, as the trust's legal executor, was automatically notified." "Automatically notified? How?" "Your grandmother was quite thorough. The trust includes monitoring provisions. When your access credentials failed to open the locks on three separate doors within a short time frame, it triggered an alert." I must have looked stunned, because he added gently, "Your grandmother anticipated potential family dynamics issues. She wanted to ensure your interests were protected." Tears welled in my eyes as the full meaning sank in. My grandmother hadn't just loved me, she'd taken concrete steps to protect me from exactly the kind of rejection my parents had just enacted. "There's more," Jonathan continued, pulling out additional documents. "The trust includes substantial educational funds that were to be made available to you upon request. According to our records, you've never accessed these funds despite completing your degree. Did you apply for these through your parents?" "No," I whispered. "I worked multiple jobs to put myself through college. My parents said they wouldn't support my business degree." Jonathan's expression darkened. "I see. That's extremely concerning, as your parents, as trustees, were legally obligated to inform you of these available funds. We'll need to investigate whether there's been financial impropriety." The room seemed to spin around me. Not only had my parents locked me out of a home that wasn't technically theirs to control, but they might have been withholding education funds specifically designated for me. "What happens now?" I asked, my voice fairly audible. "You have several options," Jonathan said, his tone becoming more formal. "As the trust beneficiary, you can invoke immediate enforcement of its terms, which would require your parents to restore your access to the property within 24 hours, or face significant financial penalties, including potential removal as trustees." "You mean I could force them to let me back in, or potentially remove them?" "Yes. Alternatively, we could negotiate a settlement that respects your grandmother's intentions while allowing for an amicable resolution. This might include establishing separate housing for you funded by the trust, while your parents continue to occupy the family home under revised conditions. I sat in stunned silence, trying to process this complete reversal of power. For my entire life, I'd been at my parents' mercy, financially, emotionally, practically. Now, in a twist I could never have anticipated, I held significant legal leverage. "I need time to think," I finally said. "Of course." Jonathan handed me a USB drive. "This contains digital copies of the relevant trust documents for your review. I suggest you familiarize yourself with your full rights before deciding how to proceed. We'll need your decision within 3 days, as the trust terms require prompt action on violations." As I stood to leave, a final question occurred to me. "Mr. Peters, how did you know my parents had locked me out? I understand the key alert, but how did you know the details?" A small smile crossed his face. "Your grandmother requested specific monitoring of the property. We have an arrangement with a trusted local contact who confirms any suspicious activity. Mrs. Henderson, my grandmother's oldest friend." The pieces clicked into place. As I left the office clutching the USB drive, I felt simultaneously overwhelmed and strangely empowered. My grandmother had seen this coming. She'd created a safety net I never knew existed. For the first time since finding myself locked out, I felt something unexpected, hope. Back at Allison's apartment, I plugged the USB drive into my phone's adapter and began reading through the trust documents. The legal language was dense, but the core message was crystal clear. My grandmother had created an elaborate safety net specifically designed to protect me from my parents' controlling behavior. The Wilson family home, the colonial where I'd grown up, the house I'd been locked out of, had been purchased by my grandmother decades ago. She'd allowed my parents to live there while raising their family, but had never transferred ownership. Instead, upon her death, the property was placed in trust with specific conditions. My parents could continue living there rent-free, and would receive a monthly stipend for maintenance and property taxes, but only if they guaranteed that I would always have a place in that home if I needed it. The moment they violated that condition, by changing locks or otherwise preventing my access, they would trigger a series of escalating consequences. First came a formal warning. If access wasn't restored within 7 days, the monthly stipend would be suspended. If the situation remained unresolved after 30 days, my parents could face removal as trustees and potentially lose their right to occupy the property entirely. "They risked losing everything just to teach me a lesson," I whispered to myself, still struggling to comprehend the magnitude of their gamble. But the property revelation was just the beginning. As I continued reading, I discovered that my grandmother had established a substantial education fund that should have been available to me throughout college and remained accessible for further education or professional development. According to the documentation, my parents, as trustees, had received quarterly reminders of these funds, yet they'd watched me work 3 jobs, take out loans, and struggle financially through college, without ever mentioning this available support. Most shocking of all was the personal letter from my grandmother included in the digital files. Dated just 2 months before her death, it spoke directly to me. "My dearest Mackenzie, if you're reading this, then something has gone wrong. I've tried throughout your life to buffer the controlling tendencies I've observed in your parents, my own daughter included, but I've always feared that without my presence, their behavior might escalate. This trust is my way of protecting you, even after I'm gone. You have always been brave enough to forge your own path, even when it was difficult. That independent spirit is your greatest strength, though your parents may see it as defiance. The funds and provisions included here are not about money, but about freedom. The freedom to make your own choices without economic coercion. Use these resources wisely, but never feel guilty for claiming what is rightfully yours. Know that I am prouder of you than words can express. All my love, Grandma Eleanor." I read the letter 3 times, tears streaming down my face. Even from beyond the grave, my grandmother had found a way to support me, to validate my choices, and to provide the unconditional love my parents had always withheld. The next morning, I returned to Jonathan Peters' office with a clearer understanding and many questions. "I've reviewed the documents," I told him after we'd settled in his office. "I'm still processing everything, but I have concerns about the education fund, if my parents have been misusing it." Jonathan nodded gravely. "We've begun a preliminary audit. The initial findings are troubling. It appears that regular withdrawals have been made from the education fund over the past 3 years, despite you not being enrolled in any educational programs during that period. They've been taking money that was meant for me, is that legal?" "As trustees, they had technical access, but the terms clearly state the funds were exclusively for your educational benefit. If they've been using these funds for other purposes, it constitutes a serious breach of fiduciary duty." The betrayal cut deep. Not only had they denied me access to financial support during college, but they appeared to have been helping themselves to my inheritance since my grandmother's death. We've also confirmed through property records that significant renovations were made to the family home last year, Jonathan continued. A new kitchen, master bathroom upgrades, and a backyard landscaping project, totaling approximately $87,000. I remembered those renovations, my mother's dream kitchen with custom cabinets and top-of-the-line appliances. My father's elaborately landscaped backyard retreat with a built-in grill and water feature. Projects they'd claimed they'd been saving for over many years. They used my education money to remodel the house, I said flatly. That appears to be the case. We'll need to conduct a full forensic accounting to determine the exact amounts and timing. I sat back, overwhelmed by the scale of deception. What are my options? Jonathan outlined three potential paths forward. First, I could pursue immediate and full enforcement of the trust terms, which would likely result in my parents being removed as trustees, potential legal action to recover misappropriated funds, and a forced restoration of my residence rights. Second, I could seek a negotiated settlement that would acknowledge the violations, but allow for a more measured resolution, perhaps establishing separate housing for me funded by the trust while imposing stricter oversight of my parents' trustee activities. Third, I could attempt family mediation with legal representation present, trying to resolve the situation while preserving some family relationship. Given what I've learned, why would I choose anything but the first option? I asked. Jonathan leaned forward, his expression serious. Miss Wilson, in my 30 years of practice, I've seen how family legal battles can unfold. Even when someone has been deeply wronged, as you have been, the emotional cost of a protracted legal fight against one's own parents can be devastating. I would be remiss not to present all options. I appreciated his candor. What would you recommend? I suggest we begin with a formal legal notice outlining the trust violations and your rights as beneficiary. This gives your parents an opportunity to respond before we take more aggressive action. Sometimes simply demonstrating that the power dynamic has shifted is enough to bring the other party to the table. It made sense. Let's do that. I'll prepare the documents today, we can deliver them tomorrow. As I stood to leave, another question nagged at me. Mr. Peters, did my grandmother ever express why she set up such elaborate protections? Did she know my parents would do something like this? He considered his words carefully. Your grandmother was a remarkably perceptive woman. During our discussions about this trust, she expressed concern about what she called conditional love, the tendency of your parents to withdraw support whenever you made choices they disagreed with. She believed this pattern might escalate after her passing. She saw it all so clearly, I murmured. Indeed, her primary concern was ensuring you would have the freedom to build your life on your own terms without economic coercion. That's why the trust includes not just housing provisions, but educational and career development funds as well. As I left the law office, I felt a complex mix of emotions. Grief for my grandmother, who had understood my struggles so deeply, rage at my parents for their deception, and a growing sense of determination. This wasn't just about reclaiming my place in the family home anymore. It was about standing up for myself in a way my grandmother had always believed I could. The formal legal letter was delivered to my parents the following day by courier. Jonathan called to confirm receipt and warned me to prepare for their reaction. It came within hours, a barrage of calls and texts from both parents, ranging from incredulous to furious to suddenly conciliatory. What is the meaning of this? My father demanded in his first voicemail. Some lawyer shows up with ridiculous accusations about your grandmother's wishes? This is outrageous. My mother's approach was more emotional. Mackenzie, I can't believe you would do this to your own family. After everything we've done for you, please call us immediately. An hour later, their tone had shifted dramatically. Honey, there's clearly been a misunderstanding, my mother's text read. We never intended for you to leave permanently. Let's talk this through as a family. I forwarded each message to Jonathan without responding directly. His advice was clear. Let the legal process work without getting drawn into emotional manipulation. Late that evening, Trevor called. Mac, what the hell is going on? Mom and Dad are completely freaking out about some trust and lawyers showing up at the house. Did they tell you what they did? Locking me out? Taking my education money? A long pause, they said you're twisting things, that grandma's trust was meant for the whole family, and you're trying to use it against them. I laughed bitterly. Of course that's what they said. Ask them about the $87,000 kitchen remodel paid for with my education fund. That can't be right. They said they saved for years. Trevor, I have the financial records. They've been stealing from me since grandma died, just like they've been controlling both of us our entire lives. Another long silence. I don't know what to believe right now. Then come to the meeting. Jonathan is arranging a formal discussion with all parties present. See the evidence for yourself. After I hung up, I felt a strange calm settle over me. For the first time in my life, I wasn't powerless against my parents' manipulation. I had truth, legal standing, and my grandmother's unwavering support, even from beyond the grave. The stage was set for a confrontation that would either tear my family apart completely, or force a long overdue reckoning with decades of controlling behavior and conditional love. Either way, I was finally ready to stand my ground. The meeting was scheduled for the following Tuesday at 10 a.m. in a conference room at Sanders and Wilson. Jonathan suggested neutral territory would be best for such a charged discussion. I spent the days leading up to the confrontation preparing both practically and emotionally. Jonathan provided me with a complete financial breakdown of the trust, highlighting specific instances where funds designated for my education and welfare had been misappropriated. The total exceeded $120,000 over 3 years, money that should have supported my education and career development. Allison helped me assemble a professional outfit from her closet, since most of my clothes were still at my parents' house. "You need to look like you're in charge," she insisted, lending me a tailored navy blazer and crisp white blouse. The morning of the meeting, I arrived 30 minutes early, my stomach in knots despite my preparation. Jonathan met me in the lobby. "Remember," he advised as we rode the elevator, "this isn't about punishment, it's about establishing boundaries and ensuring your grandmother's wishes are honored moving forward." The conference room was intimidatingly formal, a long mahogany table surrounded by leather chairs, water pitchers and glasses at each place setting. Jonathan had arranged for an associate to take notes, and for a financial advisor from the trust management team to be present. At precisely 10 a.m., my parents arrived, accompanied by a lawyer of their own, Gregory Walsh, a longtime family friend and my father's golf partner. My brother Trevor slipped in behind them, looking uncomfortable and out of place. The initial greetings were stiff and formal. My mother attempted to approach me with an embrace, but I stepped back, maintaining professional distance. Her hurt expression might have affected me once, but I now recognized it as a manipulation tactic. Once everyone was seated, Jonathan opened the proceedings. "We're here today to address serious concerns regarding the administration of the Eleanor Wilson Trust, specifically violations of the residence provision and potential misappropriation of designated funds." My father immediately interrupted, "This is ridiculous. Eleanor was my mother-in-law. We had countless conversations about her wishes for the family home." "With all due respect, Mr. Wilson," Jonathan replied evenly, "the legal documents speak for themselves. The trust terms are explicit regarding Ms. Mackenzie Wilson's guaranteed right to reside in the family home whenever needed." He slid copies of the relevant trust sections across the table. "Furthermore," he continued, "our financial audit has identified numerous withdrawals from the education fund that appear to have been used for home renovations and personal expenses, rather than Ms. Wilson's educational benefit as stipulated." My mother's face had gone pale. My father looked between his lawyer and Jonathan, clearly unsettled by the directness of the accusations. Mr. Walsh cleared his throat. "We acknowledge there may have been some technical violations of the trust terms, but these were minor administrative oversights, not deliberate breaches. Changing the locks to explicitly bar a beneficiary from the residence is hardly a technical violation or administrative oversight," Jonathan countered, his tone still professional but with an edge of steel. "Nora's withdrawing over $120,000 from a designated education fund for personal home improvements." Trevor's head snapped up. $120,000. "Mom, Dad, you said it was just some maintenance expenses." My father shot him a warning look. For the next hour, Jonathan methodically presented the evidence, financial records, property invoices, text messages documenting the lockout, and my grandmother's explicit instructions regarding my welfare. With each new piece of evidence, my parents' position weakened visibly. Finally, when the financial presentation concluded, Jonathan turned to me. "Miss Wilson, would you like to address your concerns directly?" Taking a deep breath, I looked directly at my parents for the first time since the meeting began. "My entire life, you've used financial control as a weapon. When I chose business over medicine, you cut me off completely. You watched me work 3 jobs through college without ever mentioning the education fund Grandma established for me. And when I needed shelter during a difficult time, you exploited my vulnerability to reassert control over my life." My voice grew stronger as I continued. "What hurts most isn't the money. It's that you betrayed not just me, but Grandma Eleanor too. She trusted you to honor her wishes, to support my independence even when you disagreed with my choices. Instead, you violated that trust in every possible way." My mother's eyes filled with tears. "We only wanted what was best for you, Mackenzie. We've always just wanted you to succeed." "No," I replied firmly. "You wanted me to succeed on your terms, following your plan. That's not love, that's control." My father, looking cornered, finally erupted. This is how you repay us for raising you? By sicking lawyers on your own family? Your grandmother would be ashamed. Actually, Jonathan interjected smoothly, Mrs. Eleanor Wilson anticipated this exact scenario. That's why she established the monitoring protocols and enforcement mechanisms in the trust. She left explicit instructions regarding her concerns about your controlling behavior toward Mackenzie. He produced my grandmother's letter, copies of which were distributed around the table. As my parents read her words, the fight seemed to drain out of them. My mother covered her mouth, tears streaming freely now. Trevor, who had been silent throughout most of the meeting, finally spoke. I had no idea any of this was happening. Mac, why didn't you tell me how bad things were? Would you have believed me? I asked gently. You've always seen a different version of Mom and Dad than I have. He looked down, acknowledging the truth of my words. After a moment of heavy silence, Jonathan redirected the conversation. We need to establish a path forward that honors the trust terms, while allowing for family healing if possible. Ms. Wilson has prepared a proposal. I nodded, pulling out the document I'd prepared with Jonathan's help. I'm not interested in punishing you or creating an ongoing legal battle, I began. What I want is independence and a recognition of the harm that's been done. My proposal has three parts. I outlined my terms clearly. First, the trust would purchase a small condo for me using a portion of the education funds that should have been available during college. This would provide me with stable housing while I rebuilt my career. Second, my parents could continue living in the family home, but financial oversight of the trust would transfer to an independent trustee to prevent further misuse of funds. Third, we would commit to family therapy to address the patterns of control and conditional support that had damaged our relationship for decades. And if we refuse, my father asked, though his usual confidence had evaporated. Jonathan answered before I could. Then we proceed with formal enforcement of the trust violations. This would likely result in your removal as trustees, potential legal action to recover misappropriated funds, and a significant reduction in your benefits under the trust. Mr. Walsh leaned over to whisper something to my father, who listened with a tightening jaw before finally nodding. We'll need time to review the proposal in detail, Mr. Walsh stated formally. Of course, Jonathan replied. We can give you 48 hours. After that, we'll need to proceed with enforcement actions as required by the trust terms. As the meeting concluded, my mother approached me while my father was speaking with their lawyer. Mackenzie, she said quietly, I never meant. I didn't realize how this looked from your perspective. It wasn't an apology, not really, but it was perhaps the closest she could come in that moment to acknowledging harm. I know, Mom, I replied. That's why I included family therapy in my proposal. We need to learn how to communicate without control or manipulation. She nodded, a complex mix of emotions crossing her face. As everyone filed out of the conference room, Trevor hung back to walk with me. I should have paid more attention, he said. I knew things were always tense between you and them, but I had no idea about the money or how they treated you during college. You were the good child, I said without bitterness. You never had reason to see that side of them. I want to help fix this, he offered, whatever happens next. For the first time in days, I felt a glimmer of hope that some family relationships might be salvageable, even if they would never be the same. 47 hours later, Jonathan called with news. My parents had accepted the proposal, with only minor modifications to the therapy requirements. The process of establishing my new housing would begin immediately, and I would have access to the family home to retrieve my belongings whenever I wished. The confrontation hadn't been the dramatic showdown I'd imagined, with villains vanquished and justice thunderously served. Instead, it had been something more complex, a painful but necessary dismantling of harmful patterns that had persisted for decades. As I hung up the phone, I realized my grandmother had given me not just financial security, but something far more valuable. The opportunity to break this cycle of conditional love and control that had defined my family for generations. 1 month after the settlement, I stood in the living room of my new condo, still amazed by the turn my life had taken. The space was modest, but entirely mine, a one-bedroom unit in a pleasant neighborhood, purchased with funds from my grandmother's trust. Natural light streamed through large windows, illuminating walls I could paint any color I wanted, shelves I could fill with books my parents would never approve of, and a life I could shape according to my own values. The settlement had proceeded smoothly once my parents accepted the inevitable. The trust purchased the condo and established a monthly stipend to help me rebuild while I searched for permanent employment. My parents retained the family home, but with an independent trustee overseeing all financial decisions related to the trust, a humbling arrangement for my father especially. Most of my possessions had been retrieved from my parents' house during a tense but civil Saturday afternoon. Trevor had helped, acting as a buffer when my father made passive-aggressive comments about ungrateful children, and my mother vacillated between tearful appeals and cold silence. They'll adjust eventually, Trevor had whispered as we loaded boxes into his SUV. This is the first time they've ever faced real consequences. The most challenging aspect of the settlement was the mandatory family therapy. Our first session had been nearly unbearable. My father initially refused to speak, my mother cried continuously, and the therapist, Dr. Bennett, had her work cut out maintaining any semblance of productive dialogue. Family patterns don't develop overnight, and they won't be resolved quickly either, she warned us at the end of that first difficult hour. This process requires commitment from everyone. To my surprise, my parents had continued attending. My father's participation remained minimal, but each session brought tiny moments of clarity. During our third meeting, my mother had acknowledged for the first time that her parenting had been shaped by her own mother's controlling behavior, the very pattern my grandmother Eleanor had tried to break. Mom could be so critical, she admitted quietly. Nothing I did was ever good enough. I promised myself I'd make sure my children succeeded where I had failed. I thought I was being a good mother by pushing you. It wasn't an apology, but it was the beginning of understanding. Meanwhile, I'd begun my own individual therapy with Dr. Rivera, a compassionate woman who specialized in family trauma. What you're experiencing is a massive shift in power dynamics, she explained during our second session. For your entire life, you've been the dependent one, the one seeking approval. Now suddenly, you hold significant leverage. That's a difficult transition for everyone. She helped me work through the complex emotions, the vindication tinged with guilt, the grief for the parents I'd wished for, the lingering anger at years of manipulation, and the tentative hope for a healthier relationship in the future. Forgiveness doesn't mean forgetting or excusing, Dr. Rivera reminded me often. It means releasing the expectation that the past could have been different, and choosing how to move forward with clear boundaries. Those boundaries became my focus as I rebuilt my life. With stable housing secured and basic financial needs met through the trust, I could finally pursue career opportunities that aligned with my values, rather than merely accepting any position out of desperation. I applied to a master's program in digital marketing, something I'd always wanted to pursue but couldn't afford after undergrad. Using legitimate education funds from the trust, I enrolled in fall classes, feeling a profound sense of following my grandmother's intended path. Trevor and I developed a closer relationship through this process. Free from our parents' comparative dynamics, we discovered a genuine friendship. He confessed that he'd always envied my courage to pursue my own interests despite our parents' disapproval. I did everything they wanted, he admitted during a coffee meetup. Perfect grades, right college, right career. And I'm not even sure I like being an accountant. I just never questioned it. It's never too late to make changes, I told him, recognizing how much I sounded like our grandmother. The most unexpected development came from Mrs. Henderson, my parents' neighbor who had shown me kindness during the lockout. She invited me to tea one afternoon, and revealed that she had been my grandmother's closest friend and confidant. Eleanor worried about you constantly, she told me, serving Earl Grey in delicate cups. She saw how Patricia and Robert's controlling behavior was affecting you. That's why she established the trust the way she did. You were her eyes and ears, I realized. The local contact Jonathan mentioned, she nodded. Eleanor asked me to keep watch over you, especially after she was gone. When I saw them changing those locks, I knew immediately it was what she had feared most. Thank you, I said, fighting tears, for helping her protect me. She was so proud of you, dear. Your independence, your determination to forge your own path, those were qualities she valued above all else. Those words stayed with me, becoming a touchstone as I navigated my new reality. 6 months after the settlement, things had reached a tentative equilibrium. Family therapy continued, with incremental progress. My parents and I maintained a careful distance, Sunday dinners once a month, brief phone calls weekly. The raw edges of betrayal were slowly healing, though our relationship would never return to what it had been, perhaps that was for the best. My mother had begun individual therapy herself, occasionally sharing insights about her own upbringing that helped me understand, if not excuse, her behavior. My father remained more resistant to change, but had stopped actively undermining the therapy process. The trust continued operating as designed, with transparent financial reporting that prevented further misuse. I accessed education funds appropriately for my master's program, experiencing for the first time the support my grandmother had intended all along. As I prepared for my second semester of graduate school, I received an unexpected email, a marketing internship opportunity with a growing digital agency, perfectly aligned with my studies. I applied immediately and was called for an interview. The morning of the interview, I stood before my mirror, professional and confident in a way I hadn't been during those desperate job searches months earlier. On my nightstand sat a framed photo of my grandmother Eleanor, her wise eyes and subtle smile seemingly approving of the woman I was becoming. I picked up the photo, speaking softly to her image. You saw it all coming, didn't you? You knew I'd need protection, and you made sure I had it when the time came. I wish you were here to see that your plan worked. In that quiet moment, I realized the profound gift my grandmother had given me, not just financial security, but the chance to break generational patterns of control and conditional love. She had created the safety net that allowed me to stand firm in my own truth and build a life based on authenticity rather than others' expectations. As I headed out the door to my interview, I felt her presence with me, along with a deep sense of gratitude for her foresight and unconditional love. The journey hadn't been easy, and there was still healing ahead, but I was finally walking a path of my own choosing, exactly as my grandmother had intended. Have you ever had to stand up to family pressure or expectations to follow your own path? I'd love to hear your stories in the comments below. And, if this story resonated with you, please like and subscribe to follow more of my journey. Sometimes the family we choose and the boundaries we set are the most important steps toward finding our true selves. Thank you for watching, and remember that you deserve support that doesn't come with strings attached.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.